appellation was indignantly rejected by the prince and people to whom it was applied. Whatsoever changes had been introduced by the lapse of ages, they alleged a lineal and unbroken succession from Augustus and Constantine, and in the lowest period of degeneracy and decay, the name of Romans adhered to the last fragments of the empire of Constantinople. While the government of the East was transacted in Latin, the Greek was the language of literature and philosophy. Nor could the masters of this rich and perfect idiom be tempted to envy the borrowed learning and imitative taste of their Roman disciples. After the fall of paganism, the loss of Syria and Egypt, and the extinction of the schools of Alexandria and Athens, the studies of the Greeks insensibly retired to some regular monasteries, and above all to the Royal College of Constantinople, which was burnt in the reign of Leo the Isaurian. In the pompous style of the age, the president of that foundation was named the Son of Science. His 12 associates, the professors in the different arts and faculties, were the 12 signs of the zodiac. A library of 36,500 volumes was open to their inquiries, and they could show an ancient manuscript of Homer on a roll of parchment 120 feet in length, the intestines, as it was fabled, of a prodigious serpent. But the 7th and 8th centuries were a period of discord and darkness. The library was burnt, the college was abolished, the iconoclasts are represented as the foes of antiquity, and a savage ignorance and contempt of letters has disgraced the princes of the Heraclean and Isaurian dynasties. In the 9th century, we trace the first dawnings of the restoration of science. After the fanaticism of the Arabs had subsided, the caliphs aspired to conquer the arts rather than the provinces of the empire. Their liberal curiosity rekindled the emulation of the Greeks, brushed away the dust from their ancient libraries, and taught them to know and reward the philosophers whose labors had been hitherto repaid by the pleasure of study and the pursuit of truth. The Caesar Bardas, the uncle of Michael III, was the generous protector of letters, a title which alone has preserved his memory and excused his ambition. A particle of the treasures of his nephew was sometimes diverted from the indulgence of vice and folly. A school was opened in the palace of Magnaura, and the presence of Bardas excited the emulation of the masters and students. At their head was the philosopher Leo, Archbishop of Thessalonica. His profound skill in astronomy and the mathematics was admired by the strangers of the East, and this occult science was magnified by vulgar credulity, which modestly supposes that all knowledge superior to its own must be the effect of inspiration or magic. At the pressing entreaty of the Caesar, his friend, the celebrated Photius, renounced the freedom of a secular and studious life, ascended the patriarchal throne, and was alternately excommunicated and absolved by the synods of the East and West. By the confession even of priestly hatred, no art or science, except poetry, was foreign to this universal scholar, who was deep in thought, indefatigable in reading, and eloquent in diction. Whilst he exercised the office of protospathaire, or captain of the guards, Photius was sent ambassador to the caliph of Baghdad. The tedious hours of exile, perhaps of confinement, were beguiled by the hasty composition of his library, a living monument of erudition and criticism. 204 writers, historians, orators, philosophers, theologians, are reviewed without any regular method. He abridges their narrative or doctrine, appreciates their style and character, and judges even the fathers of the church with a discreet freedom which often breaks through the superstition of the times. The Emperor Basil, who lamented the defects of his own education, entrusted to the care of Photius his son and successor, Leo the Philosopher. And the reign of that prince and of his son Constantine Porphyrogenitus forms one of the most prosperous eras of the Byzantine literature. By their munificence, the treasures of antiquity were deposited in the imperial library. By their pens, or those of their associates, they were imparted in such extracts and abridgments as might amuse the curiosity, without oppressing the indolence of the public. Besides the basilics, or code of laws, the arts of husbandry and war, of feeding or destroying the human species, were propagated with equal diligence, and the history of Greece and Rome was digested into 53 heads or titles, of which two only, of embassies and of virtues and vices, have escaped the injuries of time. In every station the reader might contemplate the image of the past world, apply the lesson or warning of each page, and learn to admire, perhaps to imitate, the examples of a brighter period. I shall not expatiate on the works of the Byzantine Greeks, who, by the assiduous study of the ancients, have deserved in some measure the remembrance and gratitude of the moderns. The scholars of the present age may still enjoy the benefit of the philosophical commonplace book of Stobaeus, the grammatical and historical lexicon of Suidas, the Kiliads of Tzetzes, which comprise 600 narratives in 12,000 verses, and the commentaries on Homer of Eustathius, Archbishop of Thessalonica, who from his horn of plenty has poured the names and authorities of 400 writers. From these originals, and from the numerous tribe of scholiasts and critics, some estimate may be found of the literary wealth of the 12th century. Constantinople was enlightened by the genius of Homer and Demosthenes, of Aristotle and Plato, and in the enjoyment or neglect of our present riches, we must envy the generation that could still peruse the history of Theopompus, the orations of Hyperides, the comedies of Menander, and the odes of Alcaeus and Sappho. The frequent labor of illustration attests not only the existence but the popularity of the Grecian classics. The general knowledge of the age may be deduced from the example of two learned females, the Empress Eudokia and the Princess Anna Komnina, who cultivated in the purple the arts of rhetoric and philosophy. The vulgar dialect of the city was gross and barbarous. A more correct and elaborate style distinguished the discourse, or at least the compositions, of the church and palace, which sometimes affected to copy the purity of the Attic models. In our modern education, the painful though necessary attainment of two languages, which are no longer living, may consume the time and damp the ardor of the youthful student. The poets and orators were long imprisoned in the barbarous dialects of our Western ancestors, devoid of harmony or grace, and their genius, without precept or example, was abandoned to the rule and native powers of their judgment and fancy. But the Greeks of Constantinople, after purging away the impurities of their vulgar speech, acquired the free use of their ancient language, the most happy composition of human art, and a familiar knowledge of the sublime masters who had pleased or instructed the first of nations. But these advantages only tend to aggravate the reproach and shame of a degenerate people. They held in their lifeless hands the riches of their fathers without inheriting the spirit which had created and improved that sacred patrimony. They read, they praised, they compiled, but their languid souls seemed alike incapable of thought and action. In the revolution of 10 centuries, not a single discovery was made to exalt the dignity or promote the happiness of mankind. Not a single idea has been added to the speculative systems of antiquity, and a succession of patient disciples became, in their turn, the dogmatic teachers of the next servile generation. Not a single composition of history, philosophy, or literature has been saved from oblivion by the intrinsic beauties of style or sentiment, of original fancy, or even of successful imitation. In prose, the least offensive of the Byzantine writers are absolved from censure by their naked and unpresuming simplicity. But the orators, most eloquent in their own conceit, are the farthest removed from the models whom they affect to emulate. In every page our taste and reason are wounded by the choice of gigantic and obsolete words, a stiff and intricate phraseology, the discord of images, the childish play of faults or unseasonable ornament, and the painful attempt to elevate themselves, to astonish the reader, and to involve a trivial meaning in the smoke of obscurity and exaggeration. Their prose is soaring to the vicious affectation of poetry. Their poetry is sinking below the flatness and insipidity of prose. The tragic, epic, and lyric muses were silent and inglorious. The bards of Constantinople seldom rose above a riddle or epigram, a panegyric or tale. They forgot even the rules of prosody. And with the melody of Homer yet sounding in their ears, they confound all measure of feet and syllables in the impotent strains which have received the name of political or city verses. The minds of the Greek were bound in the fetters of a base and imperious superstition which extends her dominion round the circle of profane science. Their understandings were bewildered in metaphysical controversy. In the belief of visions and miracles, they had lost all principles of moral evidence, and their taste was vitiated by the homilies of the monks, an absurd medley of declamation and scripture. Even these contemptible studies were no longer dignified by the abuse of superior talents. The leaders of the Greek church were humbly content to admire and copy the oracles of antiquity, nor did the schools of pulpit produce any rivals of the fame of Athanasius and Chrysostom. In all the pursuits of active and speculative life, the emulation of states and individuals is the most powerful spring of the efforts and improvements of mankind. The cities of ancient Greece were cast in the happy mixture of union and independence, which is repeated on a larger scale, but in a looser form, by the nations of modern Europe. The union of language, religion, and manners, which renders them the spectators and judges of each other's merit, the independence of government and interest, which asserts their separate freedom and excites them to strive for preeminence in the career of glory. The situation of the Romans was less favorable, yet in the early ages of the Republic, which fixed the national character, a similar emulation was kindled among the states of Latium and Italy, and in the arts and sciences they aspired to equal or surpass their Grecian masters. The empire of the Caesars undoubtedly checked the activity and progress of the human mind. Its magnitude might indeed allow some scope for domestic competition, but when it was gradually reduced, at first to the East, and at last to Greece and Constantinople, the Byzantine subjects were degraded to an abject and languid temper, the natural effect of their solitary and insulated state. From the north they were oppressed by nameless tribes of barbarians, to whom they scarcely imparted the appellation of men. The language and religion of the more polished Arabs were an insurmountable bar to all social intercourse. The conquerors of Europe were their brethren in the Christian faith, but the speech of the Franks or Latins was unknown. Their manners were rude, and they were rarely connected in peace or war with the successors of Heraclius. Alone in the universe, the self-satisfied pride of the Greeks was not disturbed by the comparison of foreign merit, and it is no wonder if they fainted in the race since they had neither competitors to urge their speed, nor judges to crown their victory. The nations of Europe and Asia were mingled by the expeditions to the Holy Land, and it is under the Comnenian dynasty that a faint emulation of knowledge and military virtue was rekindled in the Byzantine Empire. Chapter 54. Origin and Doctrine of the Paulicians. Their persecution by the Greek emperors. Revolt in Armenia, etc. Transplantation into Thrace. Propagation in the West. The seeds, character, and consequences of the Reformation. In the profession of Christianity, the variety of national characters may be clearly distinguished. The natives of Syria and Egypt abandoned their lives to lazy and contemplative devotion. Rome again aspired to the dominion of the world, and the wit of the lively and loquacious Greeks was consumed in the disputes of metaphysical theology. The incomprehensible mysteries of the Trinity and Incarnation, instead of commanding their silent submission, were agitated in vehement and subtle controversies, which enlarged their faith at the expense, perhaps, of their charity and reason. From the Council of Nice to the end of the 7th century, the peace and unity of the Church was invaded by these spiritual wars, and so deeply did they affect the decline and fall of the empire that the historian has too often been compelled to attend the synods, to explore the creeds, and to enumerate the sects of this busy period of ecclesiastical annals. From the beginning of the 8th century to the last ages of the Byzantine Empire, the sound of controversy was seldom heard. Curiosity was exhausted, zeal was fatigued, and in the decrees of 6 councils, the articles of the Catholic faith had been irrevocably defined. The spirit of dispute, however vain and pernicious, requires some energy and exercise of the mental faculties, and the prostrate Greeks were content to fast, to pray, and to believe in blind obedience to the patriarch and his clergy. During a long dream of superstition, the Virgin and the saints, their visions and miracles, their relics and images, were preached by the monks and worshipped by the people. And the appellation of people might be extended without injustice to the first ranks of civil society. At an unseasonable moment, the Isaurian emperors attempted somewhat rudely to awaken their subjects. Under their influence, reason might obtain some proselytes. A far greater number was swayed by interest or fear. But the Eastern world embraced or deplored their visible deities, and the restoration of images was celebrated as the feast of orthodoxy. In this passive and unanimous state, the ecclesiastical rulers were relieved from the toil or deprived of the pleasure of persecution. The pagans had disappeared. The Jews were silent and obscure. The disputes with the Latins were rare, and remote hostilities against a national enemy. And the sects of Egypt and Syria enjoyed a free toleration under the shadow of the Arabian caliphs. About the middle of the 7th century, a branch of Manichaeans was selected as the victims of spiritual tyranny. Their patience was at length exasperated to despair and rebellion, and their exile has scattered over the West the seeds of Reformation. These important events will justify some inquiry into the doctrine and story of the Paulicians. And as they cannot plead for themselves, our candid criticism will magnify the good and abate or suspect the evil that is reported by their adversaries. The Gnostics, who had distracted the infancy, were oppressed by the greatness and authority of the Church. Instead of emulating or surpassing the wealth, learning, and numbers of the Catholics, Their obscure remnant was driven from the capitals of the east and west and confined to the villages and mountains along the borders of the Euphrates. Some vestige of the Marcionites may be detected in the 5th century, but the numerous sects were finally lost in the odious name of the Manichaeans, and these heretics, who presumed to reconcile the doctrines of Zoroaster and Christ, were pursued by the two religions with equal and unrelenting hatred. Under the grandson of Heraclius, in the neighborhood of Samosata, more famous for the birth of Lucian than for the title of a Syrian kingdom, a reformer arose, esteemed by the Paulicians as the chosen messenger of truth. In his humble dwelling of Mananalis, Constantine entertained a deacon who returned from Syrian captivity and received the inestimable gift of the New Testament, which was already concealed from the vulgar by the prudence of the Greek, and perhaps of the Gnostic, clergy. These books became the measure of his studies and the rule of his faith. And the Catholics, who dispute his interpretation, acknowledge that his text was genuine and sincere. But he attached himself with peculiar devotion to the writings and character of St. Paul. The name of the Paulicians is derived by their enemies from some unknown and domestic teacher. But I am confident that they gloried in their affinity to the Apostle of the Gentiles. His disciples, Titus, Timothy, Silvanus, Tychicus, were represented by Constantine and his fellow laborers. The names of the apostolic churches were applied to the congregations which they assembled in Armenia and Cappadocia. And this innocent allegory revived the example and memory of the first ages. In the Gospel and the Epistles of St. Paul, his faithful follower investigated the creed of primitive Christianity, and whatever might be the success, a Protestant reader will applaud the spirit of the inquiry. But if the scriptures of the Paulicians were pure, they were not perfect. Their founders rejected the two epistles of St. Peter, the apostle of the circumcision, whose dispute with their favorite for the observance of the law could not easily be forgiven. They agreed with their Gnostic brethren in the universal contempt for the Old Testament, the books of Moses and the prophets, which have been consecrated by the decrees of the Catholic Church. With equal boldness, and doubtless with more reason, Constantine, the new Silvanus, disclaimed the visions which in so many bulky and splendid volumes had been published by the Oriental sects, the fabulous productions of the Hebrew patriarchs and the sages of the East. The spurious Gospels, Epistles, and Acts, which in the first age had overwhelmed the Orthodox code, the theology of Manes, and the authors of the kindred heresies, and the 30 generations or eons which had been created by the fruitful fancy of Valentine. The Paulicians sincerely condemned the memory and opinions of the Manichaean sect, and complained of the injustice which impressed that invidious name on the simple votaries of St. Paul and of Christ. Of the ecclesiastical chain, many links had been broken by the Paulician reformers, and their liberty was enlarged as they reduced the number of masters at whose voice profane reason must bow to mystery and miracle. The early separation of the Gnostics had preceded the establishment of the Catholic worship, and against the gradual innovations of discipline and doctrine, they were as strongly guarded by habit and aversion as by the silence of St. Paul and the evangelists. The objects which had been transformed by the magic of superstition appeared to the eyes of the Paulicians in their genuine and naked colors. An image made without hands was the common workmanship of a mortal artist, to whose skill alone the wood and canvas must be indebted for the merit or value. The miraculous relics were a heap of bones and ashes, destitute of life or virtue, or of any relation, perhaps, with the person to whom they were ascribed. The true and vivifying cross was a piece of sound or rotten timber, the body and blood of Christ, a loaf of bread and a cup of wine, the gifts of nature and the symbols of grace. The Mother of God was degraded from her celestial honors and immaculate virginity, and the saints and angels were no longer solicited to exercise the laborious office of mediation in heaven and ministry upon earth. In the practice, or at least in the theory of the sacraments, the Paulicians were inclined to abolish all visible objects of worship, and the words of the gospel were, in their judgment, the baptism and communion of the faithful. They indulged a convenient latitude for the interpretation of Scripture, and as often as they were pressed by the literal sense, they could escape to the intricate mazes of figure and allegory. Their utmost diligence must have been employed to dissolve the connection between the Old and the New Testament, since they adored the latter as the oracles of God, and abhorred the former as the fabulous and absurd invention of men or demons. We cannot be surprised that they should have found in the gospel the orthodox mystery of the Trinity. But instead of confessing the human nature and substantial sufferings of Christ, they amused their fancy with a celestial body that passed through the Virgin like water through a pipe, with a fantastic crucifixion that eluded the vain and important malice of the Jews. A creed thus simple and spiritual was not adapted to the genius of the times, and the rational Christian who might have been contented with the light yoke and easy burden of Jesus and his apostles was justly offended that the Paulicians should dare to violate the unity of God, the first article of natural and revealed religion. Their belief and their trust was in the Father, of Christ, of the human soul, and of the invisible world. But they likewise held the eternity of matter, a stubborn and rebellious substance, the origin of a second principle of an active being who has created this visible world and exercises his temporal reign till the final consummation of death and sin. The appearances of moral and physical evil had established the two principles in the ancient philosophy and religion of the East, from whence this doctrine was transfused to the various swarms of the Gnostics. A thousand shades may be devised in the nature and character of Ahriman, from a rival god to a subordinate demon, from passion and frailty to pure and perfect malevolence. But in spite of our efforts, the goodness and the power of Ormuzd are placed at the opposite extremities of the line, and every step that approaches the one must recede in equal proportion from the other. The apostolic labors of Constantine Silvanus soon multiplied the number of his disciples, the secret recompense of spiritual ambition. The remnant of the Gnostic sects, and especially the Manichaeans of Armenia, were united under his standard. Many Catholics were converted or seduced by his arguments, and he preached with success in the regions of Pontus and Cappadocia, which had long since imbibed the religion of Zoroaster. The Paulician teachers were distinguished only by their scriptural names, by the modest title of fellow pilgrims, by the austerity of their lives, their zeal or knowledge, and the credit of some extraordinary gifts of the Holy Spirit. But they were incapable of desiring, or at least of obtaining, the wealth and honors of the Catholic prelacy. Such anti-Christian pride they bitterly censured, and even the rank of elders or presters was condemned as an institution of the Jewish synagogue. The new sect was loosely spread over the provinces of Asia Minor to the westward of the Euphrates. Six of their principal congregations represented the churches to which St. Paul had addressed his epistles, and their founder chose his residence in the neighborhood of Colonia, in the same district of Pontus which had been celebrated by the altars of Bellona and the miracles of Gregory. After a mission of 27 years, Silvanus, who had retired from the tolerating government of the Arabs, fell a sacrifice to Roman persecution. The laws of the pious emperors, which seldom touched the lives of less odious heretics, prescribed without mercy or disguise the tenets, the books, and the persons of the Monastics and Manichaeans. The books were delivered to the flames, and all who should presume to secrete such writings or to profess such opinions were devoted to an ignominious death. A Greek minister, armed with legal and military powers, appeared at Colonia to strike the shepherd and to reclaim, if possible, the lost sheep. By a refinement of cruelty, Simeon placed the unfortunate Silvanus before a line of his disciples, who were commanded, as the price of their pardon and the proof of their repentance, to massacre their spiritual father. They turned aside from the impious office. The stones dropped from their filial hands, and of the whole number only one executioner could be found— a new David, as he is styled by the Catholics, who boldly overthrew the giant of heresy. This apostate, Justin was his name, again deceived and betrayed his unsuspecting brethren, and a new conformity to the Acts of St. Paul may be found in the conversion of Simeon. Like the apostle, he embraced the doctrine which he had been sent to persecute, renounced his honors and fortunes, and required among the Paulicians the fame of a missionary and a martyr. They were not ambitious of martyrdom, but in a calamitous period of 150 years, their patience sustained whatever zeal could inflict, and power was insufficient to eradicate the obstinate vegetation of fanaticism and reason. From the blood and ashes of the first victims, a succession of teachers and congregations repeatedly arose. Amidst their foreign hostilities, they found leisure for domestic quarrels. They preached, they disputed, they suffered, and the virtues, the apparent virtues, of Sergius, in a pilgrimage of 33 years, are reluctantly confessed by the Orthodox historians. The native cruelty of Justinian II was stimulated by pious cause, and he vainly hoped to extinguish in a single conflagration the name and memory of the Paulicians. By their primitive simplicity, their abhorrence of popular superstition, the iconoclast princes might have been reconciled to some erroneous doctrines. But they themselves were exposed to the calumnies of the monks, and they chose to be the tyrants, lest they should be accused as the accomplices of the Manichaeans. Such a reproach has sullied the clemency of Nicephorus, who relaxed in their favor the severity of the penal statutes, nor will his character sustain the honor of a more liberal motive. The feeble Michael I, the rigid Leo the Armenian, were foremost in the race of persecution. But the prize must doubtless be adjudged to the sanguinary devotion of Theodora, who restored the images to the Oriental Church. Her inquisitors explored the cities and mountains of the Lesser Asia, and the flatterers of the Empress have affirmed that in a short reign 100,000 Paulicians were extirpated by the sword, the gibbet, or the flames. A guilt or merit has perhaps been stretched beyond the measure of truth, but if the account be allowed, it must be presumed that many simple iconoclasts were punished under a more odious name, and that some who were driven from the church unwillingly took refuge in the bosom of heresy. The most furious and desperate of rebels are the sectaries of a religion long persecuted and at length provoked. In a holy cause, they are no longer susceptible of fear or remorse. The justice of their arms hardens them against the feelings of humanity, and they revenge their father's wrongs on the children of their tyrants. Such have been the Hussites of Bohemia and the Calvinists of France, and such, in the 9th century, were the Paulicians of Armenia and the adjacent provinces. They were first awakened to the massacre of a governor and bishop who exercised the imperial mandate of converting or destroying the heretics, and the deepest recesses of Mount Argeus protected their independence and revenge. A more dangerous and consuming flame was kindled by the persecution of Theodora and the revolt of Carbias, a valiant Paulician who commanded the guards of the general of the East. His father had been impaled by the Catholic inquisitors, and religion, or at least nature, might justify his desertion and revenge. 5,000 of his brethren were united by the same motives. They renounced the allegiance of anti-Christian Rome. A Saracen emir introduced Carbius to the caliph, and the commander of the faithful extended his scepter to the implacable enemy of the Greeks. In the mountains between Sivas and Trebizond, he founded or fortified the city of Tefris, which is still occupied by fierce or licentious people, and the neighboring hills were covered with the Paulician fugitives, who now reconciled the use of the Bible and the sword. During more than 30 years, Asia was afflicted by the calamities of foreign and domestic war. In their hostile inroads, the disciples of St. Paul were joined with those of Muhammad, and the peaceful Christians, the aged parent and tender virgin who were delivered into barbarous servitude, might justly accuse the intolerant spirit of their sovereign. So urgent was the mischief, so intolerable the shame, that even the dissolute Michael, the son of Theodora, was compelled to march in person against the Paulicians. He was defeated under the walls of Samosata, and the Roman emperor fled before the heretics whom his mother had condemned to the flames. The Saracens fought under the same banners, but the victory was ascribed to Carbius, and the captive generals, with more than 100 tribunes, were either released by his avarice or tortured by his fanaticism. The valor and ambition of Chrysocheir, his successor, embraced a wider circle of rapine and revenge. In alliance with his faithful Muslims, he boldly penetrated into the heart of Asia. The troops of the frontier and the palace were repeatedly overthrown. The edicts of persecution were answered by the pillage of Nice and Nicomedia, of Ancyra and Ephesus. Nor could the apostle St. John protect from violation his city and sepulchre. The cathedral of Ephesus was turned into a stable for mules and horses, and the Paulicians vied with the Saracens in their contempt and abhorrence of images and relics. It is not unpleasing to observe the triumph of rebellion over the same despotism which had disdained the prayers of an injured people. The Emperor Basil, the Macedonian, was reduced to sue for peace, to offer a ransom for the captives, and to request, in the language of moderation and charity, that Chrysocheir would spare his fellow Christians, and content himself with a royal donative of gold and silver and silk garments. "If the emperor," replied the insolent fanatic, "be desirous of peace, let him abdicate the east and reign without molestation in the west. If he refuse, the servants of the Lord will precipitate him from the throne." The reluctant Basil suspended the treaty, accepted the defiance, and led his army into the land of heresy, which he wasted with fire and sword. The open country of the Paulicians was exposed to the same calamities which they had inflicted. But when he had explored the strength of Tefris, the multitude of the barbarians, and the ample magazines of arms and provisions, he desisted with a sigh from the hopeless siege. On his return to Constantinople, he labored by the foundation of convents and churches to secure the aid of his celestial patrons, of Michael the Archangel and the prophet Elijah. And it was his daily prayer that he might live to transpierce with 3 arrows the head of his impious adversary. Beyond his expectations, the wish was accomplished. After a successful inroad, Chrysocheir was surprised and slain in his retreat, and the rebel's head was triumphantly presented at the foot of the throne. On the reception of this welcome trophy, Basil instantly called for his bow, discharged 3 arrows with unerring aim, and accepted the applause of the court, who hailed the victory of the royal archer. With Chrysocheir, the glory of the Paulicians faded and withered. On the second expedition of the emperor, The impregnable Tephris was deserted by the heretics, who sued for mercy or escaped to the borders. The city was ruined, but the spirit of independence survived in the mountains. The Paulicians defended above a century their religion and liberty, infested the Roman limits, and maintained their perpetual alliance with the enemies of the empire and the gospel. About the middle of the 8th century, Constantine, surnamed Copronymus by the worshippers of images, had made an expedition into Armenia and found in the cities of Melitene and Theodosiopolis a great number of Paulicians, his kindred heretics. As a favor or punishment, he transplanted them from the banks of the Euphrates to Constantinople and Thrace, and by this emigration their doctrine was introduced and diffused in Europe. If the sectaries of the metropolis were soon mingled with the promiscuous mass, those of the country struck a deep root in a foreign soil. The Paulicians of Thrace resisted the storms of persecution, maintained a secret correspondence with their Armenian brethren, and gave aid and comfort to their preachers, who solicited, not without success, the infant faith of the Bulgarians. In the 10th century they were restored and multiplied by a more powerful colony, which John Zimisces transported from the Calabrian hills to the valleys of Mount Hemus. The Oriental clergy, who would have preferred the destruction, impatiently sighed for the absence of the Manichaeans. The warlike emperor had felt and esteemed their valor. Their attachment to the Saracens was pregnant with mischief, but on the side of the Danube, against the barbarians of Scythia, their service might be useful and their loss would be desirable. Their exile in a distant land was softened by free toleration. The Paulicians held the city of Philippopolis and the keys of Thrace. The Catholics were their subjects, the Jacobite immigrants their associates. They occupied a line of villages and castles in Macedonia and Epirus, and many native Bulgarians were associated to the communion of arms and heresy. As long as they were awed by power and treated with moderation, their voluntary bands were distinguished in the armies of the empire, and the courage of these dogs, ever greedy of war, ever thirsty of human blood, is noticed with astonishment and almost with reproach by the pusillanimous Greeks. The same spirit rendered them arrogant and contumacious. They were easily provoked by caprice or injury, and their privileges were often violated by the faithless bigotry of the government and clergy. In the midst of the Norman War, 2,500 Manichaeans deserted the standard of Alexius Comnenus and retired to their native homes. He dissembled till the moment of revenge, invited the chiefs to a friendly conference, and punished the innocent and guilty by imprisonment, confiscation, and baptism. In an interval of peace, the emperor undertook the pious office of reconciling them to the church and state. His winter quarters were fixed at Philippopolis, and the 13th apostle, as he is styled by his pious daughter, consumed whole days and nights in theological controversy. His arguments were fortified. Their obstinacy was melted by the honors and rewards which he bestowed on the most eminent proselytes, and a new city, surrounded with gardens, enriched with immunities, and dignified with his own name, was founded by Alexius for the residence of his vulgar converts. The important station of Philippopolis was wrested from their hands. The contumacious leaders were secured in a dungeon or banished from their country, and their lives were spared by the prudence rather than the mercy of an emperor at whose command a poor and solitary heretic was burnt alive before the Church of Santa Sophia. But the proud hope of eradicating the prejudices of a nation was speedily overturned by the invincible zeal of the Paulicians, who ceased to dissemble or refused to obey. After the departure and death of Alexius, they soon resumed their civil and religious laws. In the beginning of the 13th century, their pope or primate, a manifest corruption, resided on the confines of Bulgaria, Croatia, and Dalmatia, and governed by his vicars the filial congregations of Italy and France. From that era, a minute scrutiny might prolong and perpetuate the chain of tradition. At the end of the last age, the sect or colony still inhabited the valleys of Mount Hemus, where their ignorance and poverty were more frequently tormented by the Greek clergy than by the Turkish government. The modern Paulicians have lost all memory of their origin, and their religion is disgraced by the worship of the cross and the practice of bloody sacrifice, which some captives have imported from the wilds of Tartary. In the West, the first teachers of the Manichaean theology had been repulsed by the people or suppressed by the prince. The favor and success of the Paulicians in the 11th and 12th centuries must be imputed to the strong, though secret, discontent which armed the most pious Christians against the Church of Rome. Her avarice was oppressive, her despotism odious, less degenerate perhaps than the Greeks in the worship of saints and images. Her innovations were more rapid and scandalous. She had rigorously defined and imposed the doctrine of transubstantiation. The lives of the Latin clergy were more corrupt, and the Eastern bishops might pass for the successors of the apostles if they were compared with the lordly prelates, who wielded by turns the crosier, the scepter, and the sword. Three different roads might introduce the Paulicians into the heart of Europe. After the conversion of Hungary, the pilgrims who visited Jerusalem might safely follow the course of the Danube. In their journey and return, they passed through Philippopolis, and the sectaries, disguising their name and heresy, might accompany the French or German caravans to their respective countries. The trade and dominion of Venice pervaded the coast of the Adriatic, and the hospitable republic opened her bosom to foreigners of every climate and religion. Under the Byzantine standard, the Paulicians were often transported to the Greek provinces of Italy and Sicily. In peace and war, they freely conversed with strangers and natives. Their opinions were silently propagated in Rome, Milan, and the kingdoms beyond the Alps. It was soon discovered that many thousand Catholics of every rank and of every sex had embraced the Manichaean heresy, and the flames which consumed 12 canons of Orleans was the first act and signal of persecution. The Bulgarians, a name so innocent in its origin, so odious in its application, spread their branches over the face of Europe. United in common hatred of idolatry and Rome, they were connected by a form of episcopal and Presbyterian government. Their various sects were discriminated by some fainter or darker shades of theology. But they generally agreed in the two principles, the contempt of the Old Testament and the denial of the body of Christ, either on the cross or in the Eucharist. Their confession of simple worship and blameless manners is extorted from their enemies. And so high was their standard of perfection that the increasing congregations were divided into two classes of disciples, of those who practiced and of those who aspired. It was in the country of the Albigeois, in the southern provinces of France, that the Paulicians were most deeply implanted, and the same vicissitudes of martyrdom and revenge which had been displayed in the neighborhood of the Euphrates were repeated in the 13th century on the banks of the Rhone. The laws of the Eastern emperors were revived by Frederick II. The insurgents of Tephris were represented by the barons and cities of Languedoc. Pope Innocent III surpassed the sanguinary fame of Theodora. It was in cruelty alone that her soldiers could equal the heroes of the Crusades, and the cruelty of her priests was far excelled by the founders of the Inquisition, an office more adapted to confirm than to refute the belief of an evil principle. The visible assemblies of the Paulicians or Albigeois were extirpated by fire and sword, and the bleeding remnant escaped by flight, concealment, or Catholic conformity. but the invincible spirit which they had kindled still lived and breathed in the Western world. In the state, in the church, and even in the cloister, a latent succession was preserved of the disciples of St. Paul, who protested against the tyranny of Rome, embraced the Bible as the rule of faith, and purified their creed from all the visions of the Gnostic theology. The struggles of Wycliffe in England, of Huss in Bohemia, were premature and ineffectual. But the names of Zwinglius, Luther, and Calvin are pronounced with gratitude as the deliverers of nations. A philosopher who calculates the degree of their merit and the value of their reformation will prudently ask from what articles of faith above or against our reason they have enfranchised the Christians. For such enfranchisement is doubtless a benefit so far as it may be compatible with truth and piety. After a fair discussion, we shall rather be surprised by the timidity than scandalized by the freedom of our first reformers. With the Jews, they adopted the belief and defense of all the Hebrew scriptures, with all their prodigies, from the Garden of Eden to the visions of the prophet Daniel. Then they were bound, like the Catholics, to justify against the Jews the abolition of a divine law. In the great mysteries of the Trinity and Incarnation, the reformers were severely orthodox. They freely adopted the theology of the four, or the six first councils, and with the Athanasian Creed, they pronounced the eternal damnation of all who did not believe the Catholic faith. Transubstantiation, the invisible change of the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ, is a tenet that may defy the power of argument and pleasantry. But instead of consulting the evidence of their senses, of their sight, their feeling, and their taste, the first Protestants were entangled in their own scruples and awed by the word of Jesus in the institution of the sacrament. Luther maintained a corporeal and Calvin a real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, and the opinion of Zwinglius that it is no more than a spiritual communion, a simple memorial, has slowly prevailed in the Reformed churches. But the loss of one mystery was amply compensated by the stupendous doctrines of original sin, redemption, faith, grace, and predestination, which have been strained from the epistles of St. Paul. These subtle questions had most assuredly been prepared by the fathers and schoolmen. But the final improvement and popular use may be attributed to the first reformers, who enforced them as the absolute and essential terms of salvation. Hitherto the weight of supernatural belief inclines against the Protestants, and many a sober Christian would rather admit that a wafer is God than that God is a cruel and capricious tyrant. Yet the services of Luther and his rivals are solid and important, and the philosopher must own his obligations to these fearless enthusiasts. By their hands, the lofty fabric of superstition, from the abuse of indulgences to the intercession of the Virgin, has been leveled with the ground. Myriads of both sexes of the monastic profession were restored to the liberty and labors of social life. A hierarchy of saints and angels, of imperfect and subordinate deities, were stripped of their temporal power and reduced to the enjoyment of celestial happiness. Their images and relics were banished from the church, and the credulity of the people was no longer nourished with the daily repetition of miracles and visions. The imitation of paganism was supplied by a pure and spiritual worship of prayer and thanksgiving, the most worthy of man, the least unworthy of the deity. It only remains to observe whether such sublime simplicity be consistent with popular devotion, whether the vulgar, in the absence of all visible objects, will not be inflamed by enthusiasm, or insensibly subside in languor and indifference. The chain of authority was broken, which restrains the bigot from thinking as he pleases, and the slave from speaking as he thinks. The popes, fathers, and councils were no longer the supreme and infallible judges of the world, and each Christian was taught to acknowledge no law but the Scriptures, no interpreter but his own conscience. This freedom, however, was the consequence rather than the design of the Reformation. The patriot reformers were ambitious of succeeding the tyrants whom they had dethroned. They imposed with equal rigor their creeds and confessions. They asserted the right of the magistrate to punish heretics with death, the pious or personal animosity of Calvin prescribed in Servetus the guilt of his own rebellion, and the flames of Smithfield, in which he was afterwards consumed, had been kindled for the Anabaptists by the zeal of Cranmer. The nature of the tiger was the same, but he was gradually deprived of his teeth and fangs. A spiritual and temporal kingdom was possessed by the Roman pontiff. The Protestant doctors were subjects of a humble rank, without revenue or jurisdiction. His decrees were consecrated by the antiquity of the Catholic Church. Their arguments and disputes were submitted to the people, and their appeal to private judgment was accepted beyond their wishes by curiosity and enthusiasm. Since the days of Luther and Calvin, a secret reformation has been silently working in the bosom of the Reformed churches. Many weeds of prejudice were eradicated, and the disciples of Erasmus diffused a spirit of freedom and moderation. The liberty of conscience has been claimed as a common benefit, an inalienable right. The free governments of Holland and England introduced the practice of toleration, and the narrow allowance of the laws has been enlarged by the prudence and humanity of the times. In the exercise, the mind has understood the limits of its powers, and the words and shadows that might amuse the child can no longer satisfy his manly reason. The volumes of controversy are overspread with cobwebs. The doctrine of a Protestant church is far removed from the knowledge or belief of its private members. In the forms of orthodoxy, the articles of faith are subscribed with a sigh or a smile by the modern clergy. Yet the friends of Christianity are alarmed at the boundless impulse of inquiry and skepticism. The predictions of the Catholics are accomplished. The web of mystery is unraveled by the Armenians, Arians, and Socinians, whose number must not be computed from their separate congregations. And the pillars of revelation are shaken by those men who preserve the name without the substance of religion, who indulge the license without the temper of philosophy. Chapter 55. The Bulgarians. Origin, migrations, and settlement of the Hungarians. Their inroads in the east and west. The monarchy of Russia. Geography and trade. Wars of the Russians against the Greek Empire. Conversion of the barbarians. Under the reign of Constantine, the grandson of Heraclius, the ancient barrier of the Danube, so often violated and so often restored, was irretrievably swept away by a new deluge of barbarians. Their progress was favored by the caliphs, their unknown and accidental auxiliaries. The Roman legions were occupied in Asia, and after the loss of Syria, Egypt, and Africa, the Caesars were twice reduced to the danger and disgrace of defending their capital against the Saracens. If in the account of this interesting people I have deviated from the strict and original line of my undertaking, the merit of the subject will hide my transgression, or solicit my excuse. In the East, in the West, in war, in religion, in science, in their prosperity, and in their decay, the Arabians press themselves on our curiosity. The first overthrow of the church and empire of the Greeks may be imputed to their arms, and the disciples of Muhammad still hold the civil and religious scepter of the Oriental world. But the same labor would be unworthily bestowed on the swarms of savages who between the 7th and 12th century descended from the plains of Scythia in transient inroad or perpetual immigration. Their names are uncouth, their origins doubtful, their actions obscure, their superstition was blind, their valor brutal, and the uniformity of their public and private lives was neither softened by innocence nor refined by policy. The majesty of the Byzantine throne repelled and survived their disorderly attacks. The greater part of these barbarians has disappeared without leaving any memorial of their existence, and the despicable remnant continues, and may long continue to groan under the dominion of a foreign tyrant. From the antiquities of 1. Bulgarians, 2. Hungarians, and 3. Russians, I shall content myself with selecting such facts as yet deserve to be remembered. The conquests of the 4. Normans and the monarchy of the 5. Turks will naturally terminate in the memorable crusades to the Holy Land and the double fall of the city and empire of Constantine. In his march to Italy, Theodoric the Ostrogoth had trampled on the arms of the Bulgarians. After this defeat, the name and the nation are lost during a century and a half, and it may be suspected that the same or a similar appellation was revived by strange colonies from the Borysthenes, the Tanais, or the Volga. A king of the ancient Bulgaria bequeathed to his 5 sons a last lesson of moderation and concord. It was received as youth has ever received the counsels of age and experience. The 5 princes buried their father, divided his subjects and cattle, forgot his advice, separated from each other, and wandered in quest of fortune till we find the most adventurous in the heart of Italy, under the protection of the exarch of Ravenna. But the stream of immigration was directed or impelled towards the capital. The modern Bulgaria, along the southern banks of the Danube, was stamped with the name and image which it has retained to the present hour. The new conquerors successively acquired by war or treaty the Roman provinces of Dardania, Thessaly, and the 2 Epirus. The ecclesiastical supremacy was translated from the native city of Justinian, and in their prosperous age the obscure town of Lychnidus, or Acrida, was honored with the throne of a king and a patriarch. The unquestionable evidence of language attests the descent of the Bulgarians from the original stock of the Sclavonian, or more properly Slavonian, race, and the kindred bands of Servians, Bosnians, Raiskians, Croatians, Wallachians, etc., followed either the standard or the example of the leading tribe. From the Black Sea to the Adriatic, in the state of captives or subjects or allies or enemies of the Greek Empire, they overspread the land, and the national appellation of the slaves has been degraded by chance or malice from the signification of glory to that of servitude. Among these colonies, the Crobatians, or Croats, who now attend the motions of an Austrian army, are the descendants of a mighty people, the conquerors and sovereigns of Dalmatia. The maritime cities, and of these the infant Republic of Ragusa, implored the aid and instructions of the Byzantine court. They were advised by the magnanimous Basil to reserve a small acknowledgment of their fidelity to the Roman Empire, and to appease, by an annual tribute, the wrath of these irresistible barbarians. The kingdom of Croatia was shared by 11 zupans, or feudatory lords, and their united forces were numbered at 60,000 horse and 100,000 foot. A long sea coast indented with capacious harbors, covered with a string of islands, and almost in sight of the Italian shores, disposed both the natives and strangers to the practice of navigation. The boats, or brigantines, of the Croats were constructed after the fashion of the old Liburnians, 180 vessels may excite the idea of a respectable navy. But our seamen will smile at the allowance of 10 or 20 or 40 men for each of these ships of war. They were gradually converted to the more honorable service of commerce. Yet these Clavonian pirates were still frequent and dangerous, and it was not before the close of the 10th century that the freedom and sovereignty of the Gulf were effectually vindicated by the Venetian Republic. The ancestors of these Dalmatian kings were equally removed from the use and abuse of navigation. They dwelt in the White Croatia, in the inland regions of Silesia and Little Poland, 30 days' journey, according to the Greek computation, from the Sea of Darkness. The glory of the Bulgarians was confined to a narrow scope both of time and place. In the 9th and 10th centuries they reigned to the south of the Danube, but the more powerful nations that had followed their emigration repelled all return to the north and all progress to the west. Yet in the obscure catalogue of their exploits, they might boast an honour which had hitherto been appropriated to the Goths, that of slaying in battle one of the successors of Augustus and Constantine. The Emperor Nicephorus had lost his fame in the Arabian, he lost his life in the Sclavonian War. In his first operations he advanced with boldness and success into the centre of Bulgaria, and burnt the royal court, which was probably no more than an edifice and village of timber. But while he searched the spoil and refused all offers of treaty, his enemies collected their spirits and their forces. The passes of retreat were inseparably barred, and the trembling Nicephorus was heard to exclaim, "Alas, alas, unless we could assume the wings of birds, we cannot hope to escape." 2 days he waited his fate in the inactivity of despair. But on the morning of the 3rd, the Bulgarians surprised the camp, and the Roman prince, with the great officers of the empire, were slaughtered in their tents. The body of Valens had been saved from insult, but the head of Nicephorus was exposed on a spear, and his skull, enchased with gold, was often replenished in the feasts of victory. The Greeks bewailed the dishonor of the throne, but they acknowledged the just punishment of avarice and cruelty. This savage cup was deeply tinctured with the manners of the Scythian wilderness, but they were softened before the end of the same century by peaceful intercourse with the Greeks, the possession of a cultivated region, and the introduction of the Christian worship. The nobles of Bulgaria were educated in the schools and palace of Constantinople, and Simeon, a youth of the royal line, was instructed in the rhetoric of Demosthenes and the logic of Aristotle. He relinquished the profession of a monk for that of a king and warrior, and in his reign of more than 40 years, Bulgaria assumed a rank among the civilized powers of the earth. The Greeks, whom he repeatedly attacked, derived a faint consolation from indulging themselves in the reproaches of perfidy and sacrilege. They purchased the aid of the pagan Turks, but Simeon in a second battle redeemed the loss of the first at a time when it was esteemed a victory to elude the arms of that formidable nation. The Serbians were overthrown, made captive and dispersed, and those who visited the country before their restoration could discover no more than 50 vagrants, without women or children, who extorted a precarious subsistence from the chase. On classic ground, on the banks of Akalus, the Greeks were defeated. Their horn was broken by the strength of the barbaric Hercules. He formed the siege of Constantinople, and in a personal conference with the emperor, Simeon imposed the conditions of peace. They met with the most jealous precautions. The royal gallery was drawn close to an artificial and well-fortified platform, and the majesty of the purple was emulated by the pomp of the Bulgarian.